This episode of the Book of Very, Very Bad Things podcast has been brought to you by our sponsors at Sweet Cheetah Publicity. Sweet Cheetah is a PR collective that values people over profit. They put a different spin on public relations by working primarily with friends and using all profits to aid charitable organizations. With a roster that includes Jawbox, The New Amsterdams, Brainiac, Get Some, Funeral Date, Damian Dunn, and many more artists, record labels, and podcasts. Sweet Cheetah! That's a great PR cohort. You can find them on social media by simply searching Sweet Cheetah PR, and they'll be there. He's been Tim. I've been Peter. And Sweet Cheetah has been beautiful. I would. Hello and welcome to another edition of the Book of Very, Very Bad Things podcast. I'm your host, Peter, and I am still here. On tonight's show, Nathaniel Shannon. Nathaniel is a photographer, artist, musician. His book, St. Vitus Bar, The First 10 Years, is now available. On this episode, we celebrate the release of this book. We discuss his art, alien pornography, Art Bell, and let's face it, this episode is basically the sound of two men becoming besties. Since we've done this episode, Nathaniel and I have grown quite close to the point that we're going to be working together on a more permanent basis coming very soon. If you dig what you hear, if you love the show, if you want to hear more episodes, please like, rate, subscribe, tell your friends, follow us on Instagram and Facebook, share our posts, follow along, choose your own adventure. I do want to thank Damian Moyel from As Friends Rust, Ecstasis, and a million other bands that he's in for getting us together, for facilitating this episode and launching something new and wonderful into my universe. So thank you, Damian. On with the show. Nathaniel and I have way too much in common to the point where I guess his girlfriend says things like, oh, isn't that nice? You found a new friend. And it is not. It's hilarious and true. I hope you enjoy this part one of a two-part episode celebrating the great, wonderful, incredible St. Vitus Bar. Without further ado, I give to you, Nathaniel Shannon, part one on the Book of Very, Very Bad Things podcast.
There we go.
Hey, how are you?
What's up, dude?
Not much. How are you feeling?
I'm alive.
I see some of those wonderful alien paintings behind you. Is it one of the labia ones or no?
Those are not the labia ones. I do have. I don't know that anybody's ever actually seen this, so this could be exclusive for you.
Oh, wow. Oh, is that cool?
It's so dumb.
That's great.
It's so dumb. This is how I spent my pandemic vacation.
What brought that on? What were you?
So Egon Schiele.
Yep.
Famous artist. My lady is a huge fan, and we're still living in Brooklyn at the time we moved to New Jersey. So audio all right on this?
Yeah, you sound great actually.
Okay. I have like my home studio set up, but It's just weird because, like, I'm not getting my own audio in the headphones. That's fine. Anyway, pandemic. We were living in Brooklyn at the time still, and we had this Egon Schiele print up in our bathroom. And I was taking a shit, and I was staring at it, and I was like, man, anybody could do that. I could do that. And this was probably like May at this point, and we were running out of things to do. And I've always enjoyed painting, never really pursued it. But I also had this like wild concept of, for couples going through the pandemic and just in general with pornography, like, what was there a spike in pornography views, or was there a decrease given that like couples are home? Are people sneaking off to like look at porn online? Are single folks more apt to look at more porn because like they can't interact with the outside world? You know, just kind of as like an anthropological observation of like, what are the stats of during a global event like this? You know, what are people looking at? And it very quickly turned into, I'm going to rip off Egon Schiele stuff to, I'm going to just make alien porno to keep Rachel, my girlfriend, entertained. So she would go to bed earlier, like considerably earlier than I would. And I would stay up till like 3 or 4 in the morning, just kind of fucking off. Cause it was like my alone time.
Yeah.
And you know, so every day she would wake up and I'd be like, look what I made while you were sleeping. To be like, you're creepy, dude. This is really entertaining. And my initial thought for it was to make a coloring book and just send it to my friends of like, hey, you know, like for those like homies that had kids, like here's something you can do at night. Just like eat some weed because we live in the future now and color alien boobs or I think all aliens have boobs, I guess. I don't know. I've never asked one. I've never had the chance to meet one to ask. But like, that was the initial goal. And it very quickly turned into like a bigger body of work. And then I was just like sitting on all of this stuff and was like, I got to do something with it.
I found you, the fact that you chose aliens as your focal point to be even more interesting, though, because you're speculating that they're going to have parts that are interchangeable with human parts. So that also begs the question, is there a fetish out there for people who want to get with alien women?
Oh, I think 100%. There's
I think so.
I forget the dude's name. He lives in New Jersey. Vice did a thing on him several years ago where he claimed that he was abducted as a teenage boy. And what would be considered like a female alien had his way with him, and he had been encountering, and he's 70s now, and he's made all these paintings, a huge body of work. And a friend of mine and I were both like pretty interested in his body of work and his story of like, is this repressed sexual trauma? Is this some sort of a scream memory? What is this that you chose to paint? Mine is a little more like Garbage Pail Kids-esque, but like these kind of graphic in detail scenes of like you having like your way, or them having their way with you. And the same friend, my buddy Brett, that like was pretty fascinated by this guy, he actually ended up meeting him a couple years ago because a coworker of his wanted to buy a painting, and they went to his house in New Jersey and like met him, you know. So is it a fetish? I don't know. I personally like have reverted back in my 40s to being like the curious 9-year-old that I think I've always been when it comes to like pretty much everything I do. Of you have these interests as an adolescent, and those interests sometimes mature to record collecting, as you know, you got that hum reissue I see behind you. And or, you know, drawing or like art in general, like what takes us out of the bedroom as kids other than like we're sitting in our bedrooms now over the internet, like talking to each other as new friends.
Yeah.
And like, that's fucking cool as shit, right? On top of, well, have our interests changed, or they have matured to a level of now, rather than absorbing this material, I can now produce this material because I have the skill set to sit and paint alien vaginas during the pandemic to keep me and my lady entertained, rather than like murdering each other, being trapped in a shoebox size apartment in Brooklyn.
And that, you know, that's, and you've heard it here first, everyone, it's incredibly healthy, in my opinion, to, you know, paint alien vaginas versus, you know, going crazy during the pandemic. I mean, I'm one of the lucky ones. My son was not even quite a year old. I'm an old dad. I'm 47. He's 5 right now. But, you know, I got to spend all of this, you know, unfettered time with this little guy. That kept me like sane. That kept me together. Sure. I of course drank a lot more than I normally do, but I think a lot of us did. Smoked a lot more weed, you know, like shit like that happens.
Yeah, sure.
But that's the healthiest choice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think I'm doing right now? Furthermore, I started this podcast because of, you know, I'm puttering around the house and my wife, I can't play music with my band. My wife's like, you need to just start a podcast or I'm going to fucking kill you. So I did. But I mean, it's incredible that you have something to show for it.
You know, what's interesting is throughout my personal history of like growth, maybe this isn't fucking interesting. Throughout all of our developments, and especially like now a couple years on the other side of Trump's pandemic, America 2020, going back into like whatever the fuck's going to happen this year. I recognized very quickly this is a really unique opportunity, because it's not like, oh, I lost my job or something happened that impedes me from participating in society. Everybody just got put on probation. Like, everybody just got laid off. So why not try and be as productive as possible? Because I don't want to wake up whenever this subsides and not have anything to show for it. And I was productive as shit. The fact that like I have to have a real job now and went back last August to like working full time again, after being able to get by doing freelance for like the last couple years, just absolutely was existentially soul crushing, because I was so fucking productive. Yeah. During the pandemic. Cause I was like, you know, my girlfriend Rachel was constantly just like kind of making fun of me, because I was like, oh man, I got this idea, so today I'm gonna explore that, and if it works out, awesome. If it doesn't work out, just on to the next thing, on to the next thing, on to the next thing. That I was kind of just like nonstop, not only as a way, I think, I don't know that I would have admitted it at the time, but like most of it was simply to just keep myself entertained and moving and like not fester. You know, we are in the unique situation of like, I don't have any responsibilities. There's nobody counting on me other than her and in me, us counting on each other, you know. But it's like, I don't have kids. I know this was a constant conversation of me checking in with friends that had kids. Like, oh, how you doing? And they'd tell me, and I'd pretend to like try and relate, but I'm just like, that's cool. I spent the whole night like watching The Sopranos and painting aliens fingering their buttholes. And then I made this thing and this thing and this thing. And I'm just productive. Cause it's like, dude, when you get as an adult, when do you get the opportunity to, I forcibly sounds more forceful than I mean it to be, but like forced into a situation or have to participate in a situation where like, this is it. Nobody is doing anything. Yeah. So just go. I looked at it. I kind of just kept joking. I was like, man, like I talked to my parents. I'd be like, is this what being retired is like? Cause I can't fucking wait. I cannot wait to be retired. If I get to just like hang out and make art and like just honestly just do shit to make myself laugh, whether anybody sees it, you know, or the couple of friends I kind of go to constantly to like bounce ideas off of like, hey, you know. Anyway,
they're not to me, that sounds like my life from probably age 7-8 years old until I was like 14 or 15.
Mm-hmm.
You know, growing up
100% what it is.
Where I did, there wasn't a whole lot to do. We had a pretty great punk scene going on here in the Scranton area of Pennsylvania, but you know, I spent most of my time alone or running around in the woods. But that was my first creative peak. I first learned to be a writer as this young kid bullshitting around, making up stories.
Right.
You know,
right,
same thing with music. It's almost like you got to have a little mini second childhood crammed in there. That's kind of impressive.
And I mini second childhood, but again, like with this skill set to actually be able to execute these ideas rather than just like throw some like paint at the wall or like color all over, you know, your parents' walls with like marker. Mm-hmm. At like 5 years old and be like, well, you know, this is your fault. This is your fault. You made me. I didn't ask to be here.
So how, like, now obviously the book didn't come about during the pandemic, right?
So to plug the St. Vitus Bar, the first 10 years book that is forthcoming here, it did kind of start because of the pandemic. So leading up to it, I was still working at Vitus behind the bar, slinging drinks to people. Everybody was very cool. They were very concerned about being cool all the time. And I was working with Carolyn Harrison, who was doing like all the social media and kind of marketing for the bar at the time. She and I had been discussing doing some sort of like gallery show. She's an incredible illustrator and has had a very cool career. She does a lot of work with bands, so everybody should check out her work. But we were discussing like CBGB had gallery, right? What is left for our community in New York, a city that is so fucking unaffordable to do anything in? What is there? There's this treasure trove of talent that comes in and out of the bar every night, doing everything you could possibly imagine, that like are struggling to show it to people, that isn't like, hey, check out my Instagram, like gives a shit.
Yeah,
you know, when we could just like hang out and like look at each other's work and in community and friendship, unity, whatever. So we had been talking to a couple spaces close to the bar, and the bar was interested in doing basically like Vitus Presents gallery shows. That was my initial intent, because I was bored and I just was like trying to figure out a way that I could show my work and curate stuff. See, another problem with New York or most places is what is being showed is fucking boring and lame, and it's just the same shit over and over again. Obviously pandemic hit, that got put on pause. So what do we do? I had been toying with the idea for a while of like doing something in print and approach them, you know, and they were very gracious and have always been very gracious as far as like opening the doors of that bar as a community center, first and foremost, you know. I mean, yeah, they sell alcohol and the Descendants played there, which was the coolest thing I've ever seen. But more than anything, it was a community center, from people using it as a gym to I can't even tell you how many photo shoots and music videos I've directed there. So they kind of kept the doors open on the DL of allowing a small circle of people to like continue to use it kind of as an art space. And within that, I started to kind of document the guts of the bar in a way that I hadn't before. They were getting ready to do some renovations with the time off, and so they wanted that captured the way that it was before. And that just kind of slowly turned into like, what if we do some sort of a book or an archival piece? And they had told me that they had been approached before by somebody about doing a coffee table book, and the time just kind of wasn't right. Because it was a couple years in, I guess, from what I was told. You know, so broaching at that point a decade, that's a huge milestone for any business to be in long a decade, let alone a music venue in Brooklyn where like the shelf life is weeks to years, you know. And it started as what I thought would be like a buck 20 pages, you know, maybe 150 pages into like, I think 344 was the final page count. You know, coincidentally, like throughout this too, William Saunders and I made the Dead Guy documentary, which also had started before the pandemic. The ideas were there. Some preliminary filming had started, but like we were able to execute that idea with such efficiency, now making kind of a weird time capsule of the advent and explosion of telecommunication in a way that had never been used before. That movie's about Dead Guy, but really it's about everybody like figuring out how to fucking use Zoom, which is hilarious to me.
Yeah.
You know, here's this archaic or non-archaic progressive technology being implemented with this band that we're so anti every fucking thing on the goddamn planet that ended up influencing two decades worth of band trying to rip them off being documented through this like new technology. I thought like, I just kept laughing throughout the whole thing, being aware of that, you know, because oftentimes I feel like in life, you're not really aware of like what's happening until, you know, the retrospect sometime later. So the Dead Guy thing documentary and even the book itself, you know, kind of really came out of this utilization of time in accessibility to people is really, I guess, where I'm going with this. Is like, had people been touring, we wouldn't have gotten them for the Dead Guy thing. Had people been touring, I couldn't have like just been like, what's up, Carcass? Do you want to talk to me about how you played, you know? And it was really incredible being kind of like a sleuth with both projects of cracking people down. And like, I would have never thought in a million years, like the, as the Americans love to say now, doing the research of gathering that kind of information to put together in some sort of archive for people to enjoy. Like, I never would have thought that that would have been as satisfying as it kind of turned out to be, you know? And the book itself, I mean, just went from, hey, I'm going to talk to my friend Pierre here, and we're going to talk about this experience of maybe we're both at the same show. And he's like, oh, you got to talk to this person. And then that person's like, well, you got to talk to this person and this person. And how quickly the kind of community of support of everyone that ended up contributing being to like, oh yeah, that's awesome. All of our collective consciousness of 10 years at this point can be visually represented throughout these pages, which was slightly my intent, but it really grew beyond what I thought it was, to the point where like, I can't wait for it to just be over and me not have to think about it for a while. I can't imagine. Can you imagine, like, you've put out records, you've played in bands, you've made art, you spent all this time, even like with a child, you know, I'm not a father, but it's like these art projects we make are like, I think, no different than children to some degree of like, there's days where you're like, man, I sure love my kid, but I fucking can't wait for it to be 18 and like, I may not have to be responsible for it anymore. Or I sure am glad my bandmate is doing this job so I don't have to. I don't know where I was going with that.
No, I get it, because like you're carrying the ball basically the whole way. Yeah. You don't have anybody. You don't have a wife in this particular parenthood situation where you could hand off and be like, okay, I need the day off from this.
Yeah.
You were carrying that nuclear football right into the end zone. but you saw it through, and the finished product, I think it does something very special in that, you know, we've all read the books like American Hardcore and you know what I mean? Like for better or worse, these tomes on Days Gone By exist. And it seems to me that most books that come out about metal and hardcore, you know, it's from the past. Even when Lords of Chaos came out, that was already 10 years down the line at that point by the time that book surfaced. This is the most of the now of the scene you can possibly be right now, because the foreword is written by Walter Schreifels, the man who's been in more Revelation Records, hardcore bands, indie rock bands, invented post-hardcore, basically. he's pan-generational. And I think that's what this book really accomplishes. It's modern, it's pan-generational, and it's, for being in print, very multi-medium, because you have flyers, photos, pieces of writing, all of the ephemera. It's all present. It's in an all-inclusive package. It's not just a coffee table book at this point. It truly is like a roadmap of where we are musically, culturally, as a scene of disparate individuals. There's nothing quite like it happening right now.
It's funny that you brought up Walter, because the conversation, I was probably like a year and a half in, and the conversation came up of like getting somebody to write a foreword. And I'm not going to name who from the bar were like, we got to get Dave Grohl. And I was like, yeah, man, he's great. That dude's never, there's some questionable Foo Fighters records, but like,
yeah,
he's an incredible musician. Seems like the coolest guy on the goddamn planet. He stepped in that bar one time and spent no time there. Granted, that was a big fucking deal. Not knocking that. I wish I had been there. But like, he doesn't have a connection to this place and what that bar specifically in New York City means for New York City the way that Walter does. And at the end of the day, everybody loves Walter because, as you said, he transcends all the music genres. Mm-hmm. And he's like the nicest goddamn guy in the world too.
He really is. Yeah.
And you know, when I contacted him to write the foreword, not only was he very cool about it, but what he ended up writing was not what I expected. And I read it and I was like, holy shit, this is so perfect. Like, and there was a handful of either interviews I did or like people that wrote things that I was just like, dude, I could have not have asked for a better response of, you know, you always have something in your head that somebody's going to do. You know, we're sitting doing this podcast. I'm sure there's questions you're going to ask me that like I made up in my head. There's responses that I was going to give you to the questions that you did make up in your head. You know, there's that that assumption.
Yeah.
So to get something that's like just the complete polar opposite of that, but so true to like why that place is important and who he is in the history of music in New York City. Like, it was just kind of like, fuck yeah, man. He's fucking Walter.
And he summed it up too, because like, of course we've been to CBGBs, you know what I mean? Like we're of that age group. We got to go to these places, but there's something very other about St. Vitus. The fact that you walk in there and like CB's was a dirt hole. We all know it. Vitus was not that, is not that. Vitus is, it's a vibe. It's very intentionally set up to be a place you would want to be in.
Yeah, it's an adult bar.
Yeah, very much so. And you walk in and there's no, you don't feel like you have to put on airs or you have to have, you know, prepared yourself to walk in. Oh, I'm going to have to deal with this now. Or like going into CB's every time, it's like, I'm going to get into a fight with the skinhead tonight. It's going to happen because it's CBGB's. There was none of that. There was an understanding between everybody who showed up, like, okay, we're all here for this. Like even when Glassjaw did their record release there and I went, I love Glassjaw, but I understand that they do come with an element that I don't necessarily love.
Yeah.
That didn't happen. What did happen was everybody acted like they were in St. Vitus.
Yeah. Everybody that was there wanted to be there.
Wanted to be there. Code of conduct. Mm-hmm. Everybody acted like adults. Everybody had a blast and there was no bullshit. That place brings that out in people that I don't think I've ever been to another bar club that has shows that was like that, that brings that sort of reverence out in us. And yeah, that's, I think what is really special, that and the fact that, you know, there's a show like 2 minutes to Late Night that gets filmed there. And you know what I mean? Where Mutoid Man was the house band, and like just so many things that are culturally still important and still happening are the focal point of these things is St. Vitus.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Mutoid Man exists because of that bar.
Yeah.
It wouldn't exist without that bar. I mean, a lot of the stuff I've made over the years in the community that surrounds that place is a direct result of those four black walls just existing and what kind of opportunity that provided for people. You know, from not only bands coming to town or getting a shot, local bands getting a shot to play like with bigger bands. I mean, I have a kind of solo weird folky thing project, and I got thrown on a show opening for Woven Hand, which was sold out. I would have never played in front of fucking 250 people. Nobody gives a shit about what I do.
I was at that show.
Were you?
Yeah.
Well, I played. I don't know if you... I'm going to pretend that you were there and watch me play.
I did. I definitely watched you play. Oh, it's just, I didn't put it together. But I'm such a massive fan of you know, 16 horsepower, Woven,
yeah, dude,
all of it.
Of course.
I couldn't not go. And I'm not one of these people that goes to a show and skips the openers, because every one of my favorite bands I've found that way, pretty much.
Yeah, everybody's been an opener. That was not important in terms of like, well, you know, from there I went on to do X, Y, and Z, but like, that's just a cool experience that I had because that place existed. They threw me on that show. I opened, you know, I went to go load in, and Chuck French, you know, from Planes came out,
yep,
and like helped me load in my gear. And I was like, dude, I love your band. We've met, you know, a handful of times throughout the years, but I was just like, oh, you're playing with Woven Hand? Like, that's awesome. Like, that's just an extra, like, I like what you do. And now I get to open doing what I do. Is that's rad. Yeah. You know, to have that kind of an opportunity, just kind of for fun, like, not, it's nothing, you know, I never took that music project seriously enough where it's like, I'm going to make it. It's just shit I do for fun, like painting aliens fingering their buttholes. you know, I don't have, I don't know that Vitus or any other bar would want that work of aliens fingering their buttholes up on the walls of their bar. Or else maybe, you know, I'll get that art opening slot being able to show alien porn.
I'd go. I'd see that.
I appreciate that, Peter.
So you're working your way through it. You're making these connections with artists that you really, you know, enjoy, you love. Was there anyone that it became impossible to nail them down for it? Because it seems to me that a project like this, people would be diving on the opportunity to have their hand on it, their fingerprint in it.
I tried for 3 years to get a hold of Dave Grohl. Came very close a couple of times, including actually being at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, because I was working in Cleveland, and like walking past him and having kind of an interaction of like a sup, but it just wasn't the right opportunity, unfortunately, to be like, hey man, do you want to be in my book?
Yeah,
you played this thing at this bar once. Which would have been fucking cool, because that Nirvana show was like such a huge deal, and took that place from being cult fan nerd aggressive music haven clubhouse to this shit is all over the world now. Like, my parents know about it because it was all over everything, and nobody knew, I think at the time, the gravitas of like what that would do, not only for more of a mainstream crowd, but also other people just simply wanting to be like, I want to be on that stage. I grew up in Michigan, and there's a venue in Ann Arbor, Michigan called the Blind Pig. that has been around since the 80s. Every band ever has ever played there, and most famous, there was a really famous Nirvana bootleg from there from like 92, before the explosion. And I remember, like, I played there a million times when I was younger, but like, I just remember standing on that stage and being like, man, Hum played here, Nirvana played here, Helmet played here, mm-hmm. Jesus Lizard played here, Local H played here. I used to just beat my face into the wall in high school because I wasn't old, like, you had to be 18 to get in. I'm just like, I'm missing these things that are like miles away happening. But to then be on that stage or like hang out and spend so much time in that room, same way, you know, light years later with Vitus, is like, I hope, and I'm sure that that there has been people many times who like get on that stage of Vitus and be like, this is where it all happened, man.
Yeah.
Like Nirvana played here, kind of.
Well, I mean, to me, walking in there and already having seen shows there a million times, but you know, Killing Joke played here.
Yeah, dude, that shit was awesome.
Fucking, like, the band that basically shaped a majority of my musical taste and, mm-hmm. you know, took me from the 80s into the 90s as, you know, this weirdo kid into whatever the fuck I became right now.
Sure.
Is probably, most likely, definitely to do with Killing Joke. Because they to me are ubiquitous. They make sense in any milieu of underground music. They
sure.
It just, Nirvana ripped them off.
Yeah.
Straight up ripped them off. Neurosis worships them. My favorite band outside of Killing Joke is Neurosis. And okay. you know, they're in a direct line with one another. The fact that they played there and I got to see them there in a room that, it's not the biggest room,
right?
But my God, to see, to be that much closer to people that you lionize as like otherworldly almost, you're never going to get the chance to have an experience like that again. And I got to see Nirvana well before Nevermind came out, and sure. that it was cool. I was happier to see the Melvins, but it was cool.
Yeah, especially the Melvins then, man.
Yeah. Like, that was height of their powers, Melvins. But to see Killing Joke in any form,
yeah,
that, sure. that close up is, I will tell my son about it and he won't give a shit about it 15 years from now, but I'll give a shit, you know.
That show is, Artie Shepherd, one of the owners, has a really great story in the book about dealing with Jazz and like trying to get him from the hotel to the venue, which is Artie's story, so I'm not going to retell it, but if you get the book you can read about it. I had been in New Orleans for a wedding. I flew back the morning of that show, went to my apartment, dropped my bags off, grabbed my camera, went and shot Black Dahlia and Meshuggah. Three songs after Meshuggah, like, it's into their set, I was like, all right, see ya. Said later to the Black Dahlia dudes, and they're like, where are you going? And I was like, Killing Joke's playing a fucking Vitus, man. And like, I got there at like halfway through the set, excuse me, but you know, I just ran in, bulldozed my way to the front, excuse me, and was able to grab a handful of photos from that show. And like, I feel, especially with the passing of Trevor and the passing of Jordy, I got to photograph like two people that are like now since removed from this life in the same night, that, you know, all revolve around the fact that at one point I was a kid just like you, listening to these records in a bedroom somewhere, that I had that opportunity, like yourself, to I'm sorry, man.
Yeah, take your time.
I, like yourself, you know, was sitting in a bedroom at one point in my life listening to these records, and then light years later we end up in the same room watching the same band that like transformed if not who we were, bands that we grew up listening to and who they were, coming back to them, you know, at some point in our adult lives. And it's interesting when you're in your own head thinking about these things, of not recognizing, I guess, again, living in the moment,
yeah,
of that kind of stuff, of like, yeah, man, I'm a Killing Joke, that's cool. Here we are, what, 6 years later from that, talking to Peter. Mm-hmm. Peter was at that show. I didn't know you were at that show.
Yeah.
But we were both at that show, and now we get to talk about it and be like, oh, I was there. And that's cool. Your kid's never going to understand.
No, but you know what? Maybe he shouldn't.
No, that's fine.
He's got his thing that he's going to discover. And, you know, my daughter's in her mid-20s, and she doesn't understand. I think she's hip to it, at least. But, you know, there's every generation gets to have their own rebellion, revolution, whatever.
Yeah, sure.
But it makes me wonder, and I have to ask you this. I don't often get into this stuff with people because it's just sometimes who gives a shit. But I think in this context, it makes sense, and it would be interesting to know, where was your start with this sort of music? Because, you know, when we're kids, we're little, we're beholden to our parents' music, what's on the radio, what's on MTV, because we were kids at the advent of MTV.
Sure.
What were the bands, what were the moments that pushed you in this direction musically and culturally?
So I grew up in Michigan, and Southeast Michigan, Metro Detroit, was in a unique situation in the late 80s, early 90s, of having a radio station that was based out of Windsor, Ontario, Canada, called 89X, which was essentially a college radio station with national or regionally national bandwidth. And one of the things that whatever the FCC is in Canada, we'll call it the CCC, one of their rules is you have to play X amount of Canadian music on your radio station. And it's like 70% or something. And so for those of us that grew up in Metro Detroit, we grew up listening to essentially like Canadian college rock radio, where rather than hearing like AC/DC over and over and over again on a rock station, it was like, oh, here's the new Catherine Wheel song. Here's Bush. And what that provided was like a really early insight into, I kind of like the Alternative Nation 120 Minutes umbrella of bands, but it allowed access to a different world than I think a lot of people in other areas in this country grew up in. And like, as an adult, it's fucking wild, especially like once Clear Channel came in and like radio just late 90s just turned out like absolute dog shit. Mm-hmm. Growing up with that, on top of like growing up in proximity to Ann Arbor, and there's a bunch of great college radio programs on there that catered to like aggressive music. But the cool thing about 89X is on Sundays they had a show called The Homeboy Show, which was all local bands. So for me, that was the first time I heard the Suicide Machines. Mm-hmm. And I would hear, you know, the Laughing Hyenas were not really active anymore, because I think by then Larissa had passed away. But like, I heard like the Laughing Hyenas and like those types of bands that at 13 is not your experience. At 23, 25 in 1992, sure, mm-hmm, that's your experience. But for like a young kid to like get exposed to like actual shoegaze and not just, you know, the Smashing Pumpkins, no disrespect, right, you know, but it was like, here's the Pumpkins and here's Pure and Mystery Machine and then Gandharvas and Limb Lifter and like all of these Canadian bands that, unless you grew up around Canada, you have no fucking idea who they were.
Yeah.
That were wildly important to me. You know, ironically, that Killing Joke show, I went to that show and met our friend Tom Keycott, who used to be on a show called Big Sonic Heaven, which was like the shoegaze kind of dream pop show on 89X. I got to know him, you know, in the last decade or so very closely. He's really good friends with my girlfriend. And but he's very old friends with Killing Joke. So he flew into town, went to the show, and he's like, "Oh, do you want to meet them?" And I was like, "No, dude. I don't want to meet Killing Joke."
No, I do not.
I don't want Killing Joke to be not what Killing Joke is in my head. And like, I probably should have like said hi to Jordy because he's no longer with us. But like, I was like, no, man, like this was a band I listened to when I was 12 on the radio because they played Killing Joke on the radio on your program.
Yeah.
I this is too weird in a very like innocent, sincere, juvenile way of like, I don't, you know, I'm just gonna go hang out with the kids in the corner, mom and dad, like I don't, you know, I don't want to meet your friend. But that radio station was wildly radically important to me, to the point where like I go back to it all the time. I have like a Spotify playlist of every cool song I could dig up from there. That it's like there's like 4,000 songs in this playlist of like this is everything from my childhood. I don't know, for those of the fans of yours that are familiar with the show Letterkenny.
I think they all are.
Yeah, it's fucking like best.
Yeah,
the greatest comedy ever. But like what's so great about that was the curation of music.
Oh, his taste in music. They mentioned Limlifter on that show, which blew my mind. And when I was a kid, I still love Limlifter.
And like that's one of those bands where I'm like, you even know who they are? That's weird to me outside of the confines of, you know, it's like growing up with like a local band. Like, I don't know who the fuck any of the bands are you grew up around from Scranton.
Right.
The same way, like you're not gonna know any of the bands I grew up around in Detroit, and that's like specific to where we grew up. But something that I consider specific, at least to the neighboring country, the fact that you had access to that in some capacity too, is also like, let's just talk about Limlifter for the next hour.
Well, the thing is, like, being from Pennsylvania, like we're far from you, but we're not that far.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And B, I was so immersed in tape trading that I got to meet people from all over the globe. And awesome. I would tape trade with these people, and like I would hear bands like Limlifter, and you know, that's how I first heard My Bloody Valentine was tape trading. Sure. You know, way before they made it onto 120 minutes. And you know, there was a whole underground community of that, especially 1987, 88. Everybody was after specifically New York and Pennsylvania hardcore bands.
Okay.
And they were sending me whatever, because I got to a point where my list ran out and I was like, just send me something cool and I'll send you this. You want the Biohazard demo? I've got that. You know what I mean? The VOD demos, plural. I have those that I can do for you. Send me what you have. And I would end up with just a plethora of incredible off the wall music from all over the place. And it was my internet.
Yeah, sure.
You know what I mean?
Awesome.
So that's how that stuff got to me. But I think if you weren't in that and you didn't have access to that radio station, you probably weren't going to hear bands like that. Same way I found Hum.
Yeah. Yeah, dude. 100%. Not only like stars being played all the time, but
even that was playing, that's the first record I ever heard by them.
Oh, okay. Awesome. Even better. I remember hearing Ironclad Lou on the radio.
Yeah.
Because they could get away with it, because somebody at the radio station, the DJ, was like a fan enough. It's like, oh, we're not going to play the radio single. We're going to play shit off the first full length, you know. Mm-hmm. And having that community of sorts. Yeah, man, those DJs were tape trading for me personally and everybody that grew up in that town. It's a really kind of cool way to look at that I haven't thought about before. And to keep plugging my book, I hope at some point some kid, your kid, any kid, picks up the Vitus book if they can get their hands on it. And that almost be a tape trading of like, well, it's not algorithms telling me, you know, what to get into, but it's like, oh, there's this bar that existed and all these bands played there. And you know, man, that guy from Obituary sure has a lot of hair. What's that band all about? You know?
Yeah. But to me, like, it's such a great resource for that specific reason, because you could go in there and, you know, look at pictures of John Tardy and then read something written by Walter Schreifels. And you know what I mean? Like, there's just so much culture happening there that's disparate. Because as much as, you know, the guys from Obituary love DRI and all the old hardcore stuff, they're still a classic thrashy death metal band. You know what I mean? You're covering a lot of ground with this, and as did the bar. The bar covers so many different, you know,
it was variety. Really, it was really important to me to like not focus on metal.
Right.
Because like the success of that place is not because Obituary played there twice. Well, technically four times, but like, you know, whatever, two weekends. That bar is not successful because Obituary played there, or Carcass played there, or Megadeth played there, or a plethora of metal. It's because everybody in between also has played there, because the owners not only have like a drastic, you know, palette of music that they enjoy, but like, so do the fans, you know. I was so excited Obituary was playing there. I'd seen them a bunch of times, but like, you know, John's hair grazed my face, you know, it's fucking awesome. But at the same time, when I found out that Hum got booked before that show got announced, I was at the beach and I lost my shit. And I was like, you gotta be kidding me. Like, my favorite band ever is playing, which is, you know, you go to those types of shows and it's like, oh, this is the same. It's the same dorks. It's all like same dorks that would be at like every other show there that all like all this different type of music. And like, pigeonholing yourself with those known as like a metal bar, I think is a complete disservice to everything that's out there. Because how is like Hum struggles to make it as a band playing the kind of music that they do any different from, you know, Karate's, well, Karate didn't play there, but the Jazz June struggles to get out of Pennsylvania and like take their show on the road any different than Carcasses.
Yeah.
You know, it's everybody's kind of in the same boat. Controversial or not as a person, Phil Anselmo had one of the funniest or like most introspective comments when I interviewed him, just talking about how what that bar does for a band destroying your ego is everybody has to walk through the crowd to get to the stage.
Yeah.
And I believe he called it the St. Vitus dance. you know, with all puns intended. But he was just like, there's nobody, whether it's me or it's like the dude in the local band, like we all do the same walk to get up there, and we're greeted by the same fan. And as you said earlier, you know, there's like an etiquette that comes with that place. And I think that that's part of it. And I think bands really recognize that if they're not assholes. There's a handful of musicians I interviewed for the book that did not have particularly kind words to say about that walk to the stage, but fuck them, man.
Yeah.
They had to do it at one point. So why is it now any different?
It shouldn't be, because I mean, it's where you started. I don't care how big you are now. We all, you know, from the most small of local bands to the biggest national acts, at one point or another, you were playing on a stage that was a foot tall in a VFW or something like that. And you had to face these people before, during, and after the show. You weren't always on that pedestal. And, sure, you know, the way things seem to run in music, you're not always going to be either. You know, there is another side.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely. So be gracious on your way up, because these are the same people you're meeting on the way down. But when you're in the mix of it, at least take a page out of Phil Anselmo's book and do the dance. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I know he is a controversial figure. He's done some shit that is just whacked out and questionable. But I still love Pantera. I still love Down. I still listen to Down on a weekly basis, as a matter of
fact. And I shot got that Pantera tour a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. I didn't expect them to be good at all like at all. And I was fortunate that my friend's Child Bite from Detroit have been taken under Phil's wing, and he's put out a bunch of their records and took them on tour, and getting to watch dudes that I know that grew up listening to 89X in Detroit influencing them, you know, listening to Failure and Shiner to Gwar and everything in between start their band, go on tour for the last like 90 years and then get to play the Garden, it was not only cool as a friend and a fan, but then to watch Pantera not suck. I honestly, like, I didn't expect them to be as good, but like, it was fucking cool, man. And again, I get, you know, like them, politics, whatever, like, I'm not here to whatever. You could swap out any band, I think, from our childhood of that magnitude.
Yeah.
But for them to be cool to their fans, cool to the band that they take on tour and treat them as equals and not just like, yeah, your room's over there, see ya, was pretty awesome. And I feel fortunate that I like got to experience that and take pictures of it, you know, especially again for my friends, you know, that dudes that I've known since I was a teenager and have been documenting since I was a teenager go on to do things that I think all of us could only dream of when we were kids. And they're not the only ones, you know, like I've been fortunate to, I don't, not intentionally like set out to document people's careers as much as I have documented our friendships while they happen to have careers in a job market that is considerably more interesting to me than like, you know, going to an office every day.
Yeah.
You know, especially people, it's like I grew up at the very beginning of taking cameras to shows and stuff, like with a handful of bands in Metro Detroit that I really, really loved a lot. And going from that influence of the radio station to like, oh man, what's going on the other side of the tracks, to, you know, watching that happen at the most famous arena in the United States, at least, was like pretty fucking cool.
Yeah, and Child Bite, I mean, they're kind of undeniable. They're one of those bands that when they started to really happen, it happened quick because they were that fucking good. I mean, there's just no question about it. And I can tell you, I've seen Pantera for the first time play in a roller skating rink in this area.
That's awesome.
I met them all that night, and they were pretty fucking cool. And every time I've talked to any member of Neurosis and they come up, they talk about those guys like they are the greatest people on earth. And so did my late friend Pete Steele.
Mm-hmm.
Loved Pantera. So for maybe, you know, you got to take it, you got to look at it on, you know, the macro.
Yeah.
They treated a lot of people really fucking well.
I was surprised. I guess I shouldn't say I was surprised. I kind of knew this was happening, but I just didn't get to experience like how much of their touring crew is still people that toured with them in the 90s.
Yeah, and watch the Vulgar video and it's still
that are just like part of the family, you know, and to see that and just kind of wander around backstage and just like, not to sound like a jerk off, but it's like, man, I've been backstage at arenas. It's not that cool. It's normally chaotic and like fucking super uninteresting and everybody's stressed out and it's just, it's not a fun environment. This wasn't being backstage at Pantera in like 1991, you know, where they're like butt chugging beers off of each other and stuff, but like popping pimples, but it was professional and friendly in a way that like I have never seen backstage anywhere, where everybody was just cool and nice. And we're talking the Garden, which is a union venue full of the fucking worst people that work at venues, like work at arenas. I've worked in and out of the Garden a bunch of times. It is generally not a good experience. Not that I'm talking shit about unions in New York, because I'm not.
No,
but
no.
I'm talking shit about that union because all those people are fucking garbage. But like, it was not that. Like, everybody was just like, "You got to be off stage at 9 o'clock." Okay, cool, got it. You know, it was just like the least hilariously, like the least aggressive New York experience I've ever had at like the biggest venue in the city, but.
But you get this experience often, though, correct? Like you go and you professionally shoot these bands as a vocation, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's allowed. Having a camera has allowed me to do a lot of stuff for free, and that's the way I've always looked at it. Is like, yeah, man, I'll come to this and take pictures because you're just going to put me on the list and I have to pay to get in.
Yeah.
And some of those opportunities have turned into bigger opportunities. And, you know, I'm a fan more than anything. And my career behind the camera has taken me to where it has been, where like I have a little bit of, I've had some luxuries and liberties to kind of like do whatever I want. Because rules are bullshit, especially when it comes to shooting music. And unfortunately, we live in a digital age where like there's too many fucking people with too many cameras everywhere, and it is saturated. This is my old jaded punk rant. It's saturated being able to shoot. Yeah. You know, I shot King Diamond at the King's Theater in Brooklyn several years ago. Fucking awesome.
Wow.
A, because it's King Diamond. B, because that venue is just absolutely beautiful. Old 1920s theater, gold box seats. It's so cool. Such a great place. There were 4 fives people fucking shooting that show.
Wow.
That is 16 people too many shooting that show, where it's like everybody is like in each other's shit and in each other's way trying to get that shot. And I was like, this is not fun. Like, this is exactly why I kind of hate this environment sometimes. And like, I'm not denying people their right to be there, but in a get off my lawn type way, when I shot film, you didn't have fucking 20 people up shooting anything ever.
Yeah, because
you had four, and they knew exactly what they were doing and why they were there. And that kind of stuff has kind of made it not so much fun anymore to be able to just take pictures the way that I'm good at taking pictures and not have to deal with like 40 people with their digital cameras like looking at their screens every 2 seconds to make sure that the exposure is right, when like if you know what you're doing, you can just walk in a room and know.
Yeah.
Ansel Adams's photography is fucking boring. However, that motherfucker knew the math of his cameras and could just open his lens and just knew what the exposure was. And like, I've read so many interviews with him, and I've kind of always been enamored with like his ideology more than like his actual work. Simply because that motherfucker knew walking into any environment what to do and didn't have to just be like, oh well, you know, what does the back of the camera say? That's my rant that makes me sound like an asshole, but I don't give a shit. Like, no. I've been doing this for so long that it just makes it not fun. To completely pat myself on the back, Botch did this last run of shows.
Yeah.
And like, I've, you know, had the fortune to like meet those dudes over the years, photograph their other projects. And one of my oldest friends that I used to play music with like 20 years ago came into town, and because they were a very important band to us, and we went to the show at Webster, and I had gotten a photo pass, and they did a really cool thing where Webster Hall wanted them to have the barricade all the way against the stage and no photo pit. And the band was like, no, we need to have something. And they were like, well, you know, insurance, blah, blah, blah. Kids are going to get hurt. A bunch of fucking 45-year-olds drinking craft beer are going to like crowd surf. Bunch of old fat dudes are gonna like try and climb on top of each other. Well, you know, Dave detunes his guitar on stage. I get it. But the band made a concession with the venue that rather than get rid of the photo pit, but anybody that brings the camera to the show can shoot from anywhere they want with flash, no rules. And the venue was like, okay. It's the only time I've ever seen that, where the band was like, anybody can do this.
Yeah.
But they have to stay beyond the barrier. I, of course, because I'm an asshole, went to the band and was like, look, dudes, I've been taking pictures of all of you for a very long time. Can we make an exception for your boy over here? And they were like, we'll see what we can do. So I ended up shooting the second night in front of the barricade for three songs. And it was really cool to be there with one of my oldest friends who that band meant so much to me with, and be able to be like, yeah, I have this clout now, man. We used to go get punched in the face watching hardcore bands play in Detroit, but I just finagled my way into being the only person that gets to shoot botch from front of the balcony for three songs. And I, you know, back to being present in that moment, like, I didn't take that for granted at all. I was like, this is fucking cool. And I waited 25 years for these types of moments of having the trust of whoever's in front of my lens to allow me the opportunity to do things my way and not just be like, oh, here's no flash, just stand up there, 40 other people up here, you know. And it was cool, and I'll forever be grateful to them, especially Brian Cook. It's a fantastic person, fantastic human.
And they wrote American Nervoso. I mean, talk about a record that was earth shattering to me personally as well.
Yeah, fuck yeah, dude.
Botch and Converge and you know, Isis, like that whole era of Hydrahead music.
Yeah, man.
That was really like, I came into punk and hardcore right around when the Youth Crew thing was happening.
Sure.
The original, not the rebirth of Youth Crew stuff.
Back when you were still a youth.
Yeah, back when I was actually young, you know, when Revelation was still in New York City. And that was obviously very pivotal, that point. But that era of, like, when Hydrahead first started really getting big with Cave-In and everybody. And to me, that handful of, like, 10 or 12 bands, I will love them forever. You know, I love the Rolling Stones or I love Black Sabbath because they encapsulated a point in my life where music really became everything again. Mm-hmm. Because there was a time in this music where I lost a lot of interest because it got all very samey, you know. Mm-hmm. Like after the whole post-hardcore movement, which I loved, things fell off.
Yeah.
But then this happened and it was like, oh, wait a minute. You can still do something different with this and yeah, make it vital and have it be alive. And I can take part. I can be there for all of it.
You mean these people actually know how to play their instruments?
Yeah. Yeah. It's even crazier. Like the first time seeing the Dillinger Escape Plan, like, yeah, wow, these guys they're like, these are jazz musicians. Look at what they're doing. You know, same thing with Candiria. When Candiria used to play, they played around here. Like they were a local band almost.
Yeah, sure.
Watching Kenny Schalk behind a drum kit was like watching Rush.
Yeah, fuck yeah, dude.
You know what I mean? Like, it's like looking at Neil Peart, like, holy shit, this guy is incredible. And we got to have all of that. And maybe these bands never reached the same heights as some of the other bands I'm mentioning, but my God, to have lived it, to have a reference for it, to me is very special. Again, that's like in terms of this book, I think it has that spirit of like being something very special and having a viewpoint of it, a very specific viewpoint of it, and letting everyone else in on it. Like here's the way I see it.
You bring up a great way to segue into like the ocular design of the book in the chaos of what you're talking about, as far as like the sounds of the bands you're describing. I am not a designer. I know what I think looks cool. What I think looks cool doesn't really follow any rules the same way that a designer would. I'm not saying that that makes me any sort of like idiot savant authority on the matter, but when I started to design the layout of the book, I had no idea what I was really doing. And I resorted using the influence and critique of a handful of friends, including, you know, both of my old roommates in Brooklyn, specifically like Toby Trier and Jay Morris. Jay Morris did a lot of the posters for the book. Incredible poster artist and like logo designer. And Damien Moyel, our mutual friend. And I called Damien one day because I was just like, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing, man. And he was like, you know, what works about the design element of the book is you don't know what you're doing, so you're not following any rules. And the book sounds like the bands that are playing here. And it's all over the place. Some pages are like very quiet. Some pages are very obnoxiously loud and kind of all over the place. And I really wanted to like mirror what I thought like a magazine layout would be, rather than a traditional like here's our book. And I wanted it to be fucking just chaotic and shit everywhere, because when you walk in that bar, it is chaotic and there's shit everywhere. There's so much stuff behind the bar that they've collected, or behind the bar that they've collected. There's the bathroom is tagged, there's flyers, there's this, there's that. It's not, you're not just walking into a blank canvas. And I think one of the strengths, in my own defense of ignorance of the book, is how chaotic it is. I was able to bring on Eric Palmerly, who's a very old friend, incredible designer, and he helped me kind of tighten up where I was going, because it was getting a little much, and he really took kind of what I started out doing and took it to the next level of like a little bit more professional tightness to page by page turns of how everything was laid out. But it was very important to me to not just do like flyer, picture, flyer, you know, where it was just like every page I kind of treated almost more like a collage of like what I thought and had access to, either by posters, quotes, or photos, what I thought represented that band the way I heard them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, I find the pacing of the book to be very much like a song by one of those bands that we were talking about, in the pacing, because, you know, you start out like you open the book and you have the foreword by Walter, and it all looks very nice, and then you're hit with a barrage of flyers. You know, it just it ebbs and flows in such a way that, although, you know, you're claiming ignorance of design, there is a design to it. That design to me feels like a song more than anything else. I could tell you're a musician by the way it's paced, because it does, not in a verse chorus verse type of way, but in the sense of building intensity,
yeah,
and then maintaining it, and then knowing when to pull it back, and you know, still include the information and still make it cohesive and make it flow.
We've studied liner notes our entire lives.
Yeah.
You've got a shit ton of records behind you. I've got a shit ton of alien. Oh, that's not alien porn. That's actually my grandma's ashes painted into a painting of her. But not in a weird way. It's her and my mom and two sisters and painted the grave, whatever.
That's all.
But my point is like, I did that because at some point there was something I probably saw in a record that made me get to whatever the dominoes fell in my life to get to that moment to make that painting. The same way I tried to pace the book like a track listing and what I would respond to, because I don't give a shit what like you respond to. I mean, I do. But right. I want praise and adoration for whatever I do, just like anybody. But like, it was going to be, it really was like, what am I going to pick up and engage with if I didn't make this, versus just another coffee table book about something? A couple books that I found to be really striking that way were Tom Berzhowitz, who also contributed to the book, was responsible for putting together the Misfit Scream With Me book, which I admittedly shit all over that book, because I think that while I love Danzig's solo career and I love the Misfits as a band, the Misfits as a band fucking just ruined their entire legacy by like bickering.
Yeah.
Like old Italian grandmas about goddamn everything. And it sucks. So when that book came out, my girlfriend bought it and I refused to, because I'm an asshole. I refused to look at it. And I was like, fuck that band. Don't care. Don't care. Whatever Danzig's got his hands in now, do not give a shit. And I very early on was thinking, after I started gathering material for the book, I was like, I got to figure out how I'm going to put all this together. So I went through our bookshelves and I was like, I should look at that Misfits book. And I opened it and I was like, fuck, man, I'm an asshole. This book is incredible because the band had nothing to do with it, so they couldn't ruin it.
Yeah. Yeah. It was his vision and not theirs.
And, you know, it's funny because we ended up contacting Tom for some Dead Guy stuff, and he's a fantastic human. And I didn't make the connection at first that it's like, oh, this is Tom that gave us stuff for Dead Guy, is the same dude that made this book that I shit all over, because Doyle is Doyle, and like, fuck, whatever, Doyle. go lift some weights, man. But that became like a huge influence of what I wanted to do. And I like wrote Tom an email and was like, look, man, I just put two and two together. Like, what you made is fucking so impressive because it solidified the legacy of the band without the band ruining it. And it was everything that's ever been cool about them.
Yeah.
And not all the bullshit. And that's awesome. How do you get around and make something that is simply about a legacy and not about like, well, who's the owner or who did this or who's lawyer or who's the singer? It's just like, no, here's the archive of what happened and why people gave a shit about that band, gave a shit about the bar. The other one was Melodic Virtue put out the Pixies book.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And I hilariously just met Aaron from Melodic Virtue at Pantera, because he's really good friends with Childbite, and like we were talking and he's like, oh, I put out books. And I was like, oh yeah, like what? And he started telling me. I was like, oh shit, dude, like all of your books are incredible. Like you're one of the few, I think, people making visual legacy pieces that are more like little page, you know, made out of trees documentaries than like anybody else out there. And I was like, that Pixies book is awesome because it's not about Frank Black fighting with Kim Deal.
Yeah.
And it's not about how I don't understand any of their music of the last 20 years. It's simply like, here's a bunch of letters that Frank Black wrote to his family. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
Oh, I like,
oh yeah, it's fucking awesome, dude. Yeah, I opened it. I was like, here's a letter talking about him. He's like, I'm no longer an archaeologist. I'm going to be a rock and roll musician.
Yeah.
But like to read that handwritten stuff and then just be like flyers and archive info, I was like, this is why I love this band. It has nothing to do with any of like the kind of tertiary existential issues of like, it now become like an eye roll of like, so you got another young girl to play bass and like kicked her out after, yeah, you know, she got too old. I'm like, all right, man. R.I.P. Paz's career. Or whoever the last female was. She was great, by the way.
Well, I saw them. Paz was, I thought she was back in the band.
Oh, is she? I don't know.
But she,
the last time I saw them, they had whoever replaced her, and she was fantastic. Joey was fantastic, because Joey's always fantastic.
Oh, he's great.
And David Levering was fantastic. I met him once in Detroit. I was, there's a completely non sequitur going off in a different direction, but I just thought about this and it makes me laugh every time I think about it. I had been, there's a venue in Detroit called St. Andrew's Hall, upstairs, downstairs. upstairs is like Irving Plaza, downstairs is like kind of like studio at Webster Hall, you know, like smaller. And David Lovering was opening for Buffalo Tom doing his like Mr. Wizard Magic stuff.
Oh, that's great.
And I was like, wait, like Mr. David Lovering? Like the David Lovering? I was like, I gotta go down there. And a friend of mine was doing sound for the show, and he's like, yeah, dude, it's like David Lovering from the Pixies. I was like, can we meet him? And he's like, yeah, he's really cool. And so like we went and we met him, and I took a Polaroid of him, and I was like, Pixies reunion? And he's like, never gonna fucking happen. Sure enough, like a year later, this was 2003, so sure enough, like, yeah, 2004 they got back together. But he made everybody sit down on the floor and then just started doing magic tricks. And I was like, dude, you went from playing drums in, I think, the greatest rock and roll band of the last 30 years,
yeah,
undeniably influential to literally everybody, and besides probably my favorite band ever, to doing magic, and like you're good at it, and it's awesome to watch.
I thought the way that the manner in which they painted him in that documentary pissed me off.
Mm-hmm.
Because the guy, like, of course, yeah, he had a problem, but like
he's just doing his thing.
They made him look like so much worse than what he was actually doing, that, like, you know what I mean? It's all about perspective, I guess.
Yeah. But that's one of those things of like, is he fucking up your shows? Is he showing up to work? And is he playing drums and dealing with Frank Black?
I mean, he was on Xanax. I mean, really? That, if that's your biggest sin, cool, bro, like you're every housewife and like disaffected boss I've ever had. Like, come on.
I photographed Frank Black and the Catholics in Detroit in like 2000 something, early, like 2002 maybe. And I was standing up front, and in the middle of one of his songs, he just points at me. He's like, you, get the fuck out of my face. And I was just like crushed.
Oh, God.
Because I'm like, dude, for real, man? You wrote Mr. Greaves? Like, do you have an opinion, Frank Black? And like, he pointed at me and it was like, get the fuck out of my face. And then I took some more pictures. He's like, I'm talking to you. And then he just started yelling at me. And I turned around and I was like, oh, there's like three babes behind me. And I, you know, I maybe I'm being presumptuous, but I was like, is Frank Black just trying to like holler at these people, my, like women my age, like in their early 20s? Like, that's, it's funny. But it, like, it bummed me out super bad. In that same venue, about a year later, I shot the Breeders and had a similar experience with Kim Deal, where she also like yelled at me for taking pictures of them. And it, you know, I at that point was like, I'm still just 3200 speed, black and white film, no flash. Like, flash is bullshit. Very like, it's about as straight edge as I got was no flash, fast film. And I was like, why are you, so two out of the four Pixies have yelled at me for taking their pictures, but David Lovering fucking ruled. And I have never met Joey Santiago, but he's always been a little bit of a personal hero. So
it's a shame, but I'm not surprised, because they're the two most mercurial members of the band.
They're the best parts.
Yeah.
They're the best parts of that band.
And there you have it, my friends. The end of part one of my interview with Nathaniel Shannon. Part one, more about the book, more about how he got into music, things of that nature. In part two, it gets more personal, more hilarious, and it's the reason why I love this guy so much. So I hope you stick around and check out part two, coming later on this week. From all of us at 3:33 AM Studios, he's been Nathaniel Shannon, I've been Peter, you've been beautiful, and this has been the Book of Very, Very Bad Things podcast. Take care of each other. I'll see you in a couple days. Later, skater.